Street in Portland. It includes a salmon dinner and a silent auction, as well as speeches and a cultural arts presentation. Again, that's a night with Wisdom of the Elders, Friday, June 20th at 6:30 p.m. at the Melody Ballroom in Portland. More information about this event may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Well, yes, folks, we all are moles in the ground, writhing together in our blissful state. This is your Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Among other things, the Old Mole provides hope in hard times. Yes, today the lords of commerce are now dominant. They monopolize power and they sit high in the saddle, but they are not going to last. They have set up a system that can't endure. It's unsustainable. It demoralizes so many people. It undermines the ecosystems that sustain human life. Yes, our lords of commerce could destroy everything, or they might be replaced. By whom, you ask? There will be two contenders. One will represent the military and corporations. They'll create a strong state, a police state, declaring martial law, abrogating constitutional guarantees, and trying to grab the remaining resources of the planet, that in vain, to save themselves. There is another possibility. The replacement for our current system could be the cooperative commonwealth, that better possible world that's pretty egalitarian and produces democratically through cooperative places, democratic councils, people working a lot less, less drudgery, having much more time for fulfilling social public lives, in which decisions are made about how they want to live together, and they're made democratically. This is surely possible. Right now on the planet, us ordinary humans, remember, an extraordinary species, we live, we have created millions of organizations, work organizations, schools, churches, sports teams, not to mention the hundreds of millions of families and neighborhoods that cooperate and operate democratically. And moving towards this model is the only answer to saving the planet. Restoring the health of life-giving ecosystems. Anyway, that's my faith. On today's Old Mole, I'm Bill Resnick. I interviewed Joseph D. Philippus on marriage equality and what's next for the LGBT movement. Jan Hocken interviews Sophia Smith on resisting homeland security harassment and providing humanitarian aid along the U.S.-Mexico border. Also today, we do a primer on what's happening in Iraq, how it is that government forces that the U.S. so lavishly supported, how these collapsed, leading to jihadist capture of large sections of northern Iraq. The music today is West African instrumentals and drumming, and we interview the organizers of an evening of West African dance and drumming coming this Friday to Portland State University. It's a celebration in Lincoln Hall. And we'll start today's show with some of the drumming. Then after the music, I'm Bill Resnick, your host today. I talk with Joseph D. Philippus on what comes after marriage equality. Joseph D. Philippus, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here.
Joseph D. Philippus was one of the founders of Queers for Economic Justice, a very influential LGBT organization in its day. He now studies and teaches at Portland State, writes a good deal. He co-wrote the statement Beyond Same-Sex Marriage and co-edited the online book A New Queer Agenda. Joseph DeFilippis, you've been critical of how the Marriage Equality Campaign has operated and its impact on the larger LGBT movement. Give us your assessment of the marriage equality movement now that it's actually coming to prevail. It's exciting times for them.
Yes, 20 states have legalized gay marriage, and for many people that's very exciting news. It's certainly a huge help for same-sex couples that want to get married, you know, and it seems pretty inevitable that we will see it across the country. Yes, it's been a very problematic movement in many ways for a variety of reasons. I and many others have been very critical for years about the way in which it has diverted almost all resources and almost all funding for LGBT issues away from a variety of other issues that are really life and death issues, such as poverty and homelessness and the criminal justice system and health care and hate crimes and many other issues that really are life and death issues for many communities. I'm hoping that as this campaign is successful for gay marriage, that funding for LGBT issues will not disappear, that it will return to some of those other crucial issues that have been ignored. It also has been a really problematic movement for other reasons, though. For instance, it only benefits same-sex couples, which is not actually the majority of LGBT people. And LGBT people, actually much like heterosexual America, build our families in much more complicated ways beyond just a husband and wife or two husbands and two wives. For a gay couple that impregnates a lesbian couple and raises a child jointly with four parents, gay marriage doesn't protect that family. There's many, many complicated ways in which queer people build our families, and we need a variety of laws that protect a variety of families. And so things like domestic partnerships or civil unions or reciprocal beneficiaries have actually been really helpful for many, many families. And unfortunately, the gay marriage movement has viewed those things as merely a second-class status on the assumption that they exist only to protect people who would rather be married but couldn't get married, and so they'll settle for domestic partnership. And certainly that's been true for many people, that it has been a second-class form of marriage. But for many, many other families, marriage is actually not what they need or want, that these other menu of items, of ways of protecting diverse families, are really crucial. And what we're seeing as a result of the gay marriage movement is that these other options are disappearing. So I'm in Oregon, and our neighbors in Washington, when they got gay marriage, they did away with domestic partnerships. We saw this happening in other states around the country before it happened in Washington. It happened in Connecticut. It happened in New Hampshire. In New York State, where I'm from, as soon as it approved same-sex marriage, the school district in Washington County did away with their domestic partnership benefits. And domestic partnerships were never created. They've been used as a second-class marriage, but that's not what they were created for. They were actually created to protect people who weren't married. They were actually originally started for heterosexual folks who weren't married but wanted their relationship protected in some way. And it's always been used that way. And gay marriage activists have really used a rhetoric and a strategy that demonized and minimized these other forms of protections in their pursuit of marriage.
So there's all sorts of people who are heterosexual, and either heterosexual or, in fact, whatever their sexuality, and may be very, very diverse and may not see themselves within the LGBT community, they've also lost their capacity for these all sorts of social benefits they had won.
Absolutely. In fact, most domestic partnerships in every single city or municipality across the country that offer domestic partnerships, the majority of them have been used by heterosexual couples who always had the right to get married and for whatever reason couldn't or didn't want to. And now they are losing those protections, as are complicated queer families. Many of us have been saying it's unfair that same-sex couples can't get married if that's the way you get protections and benefits. But why is that the way that you get protections and benefits? Why do you have to get married in order to get your partner's health insurance? Why haven't we been fighting for universal health care instead? Why do you have to be married to have your spouse make medical decisions for you when heterosexual studies have shown heterosexual people don't even want their spouse? Like, I think it's like 56% of heterosexual married couples don't want their spouses making medical decisions for them anyway. They would rather have their sister or their best friend or their cousin or their mother or whoever it is. So the idea that you have to get married to get all these rights is really problematic when these rights should be separate from marriage, and marriage should just be, oh, I don't know, a personal, emotional, romantic, cultural, social, psychological thing that you do with the person you love and the community you want to be surrounded by and maybe the religious organization you're part of. But to have the state involved and say these families are legitimate and will get protections and benefits and these other families are not, that's a problem. And gay marriage and gay marriage activists have contributed to that rhetoric by often stigmatizing unmarried couples in language that sounds very similar to the racist rhetoric around welfare and unwed mothers. They mimic the same language of marriage is the only way that a family can be valid and kids need two married parents to raise them, and using all of this really conservative rhetoric that has been really problematic, especially given that LGBT families, the majority of them, are not as simple as two people in a romantic relationship. Uh-huh. There are step siblings and kids and donors, sperm donors, and multiple people living together, like the Golden Girls, taking care of each other when they age. Like, there's a lot of family constructions that are left out of marriage.
And the emphasis on marriage as the way of becoming eligible for various kinds of benefits, it seems to me it really works to the disadvantage of the poor and is particularly seen in things like public assistance. That seems to me cuts off the LGBT movement from all of the other sort of from the social justice movements, and especially with regard to health care.
Absolutely. I mean, the gay rights movement, the gay marriage movement has been really out of step with other social justice movements in this country for a variety of reasons. I'm thinking of another example. I'm looking at how we have embraced hate crime legislation in this country during the last 20 years. And hate crimes are a real problem against LGBT people. Absolutely a real problem. But the idea of enhanced penalties and sending people away for longer as the solution is so problematic when every other social justice movement in this country for the last 20 years has been trying to disempower the criminal justice system. It's been trying to say we lock up too many people for too long, like no other country in the world. Like, our movement that we're in has embraced very many conservative tactics. And the marriage rhetoric is very similar to the tough on crime rhetoric that they could be. You could hear the exact same words on Fox News coming from conservative politicians as you hear from many gay rights activists. The language is almost identical.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Joseph DeFilippis. He's one of the founders of Queers for Economic Justice. Joseph, you've been critiquing the marriage equality movement based on its narrowness. It's also narrow in several other ways that it seems to me is really problematic. That is that it begins with sort of notion and constantly promotes it. We are just like you. We want to settle down and be stable and live in the suburbs and have children and a dog and just live like any other couple, except that our sexual preferences are somewhat different, and be devoted to one another and to family and make family first. They're using the most sort of traditional kinds of values to promote gay marriage. And it seems to me that's really a huge disservice for absolutely everybody in a way, because it privileges those very repressive sorts of ways of looking at human relationships.
I would agree. I mean, I think it's problematic for multiple reasons. The gay rights movement's origins were really radical origins in many ways, that was fighting for sexual liberation, that was fighting for a sense of community and larger issues of social justice. And it really has been watered down in the last couple of decades to this "we're just like you" message. And that's problematic for other reasons, not only because of the issues we're no longer tackling, but also when we say "we're just like you," who is the you? The you tends to be, we're just like who? We are just like white middle-class people who have these white picket fences, right? We're not saying we're just like you, low-income black person. It's a very racist and classist message, and the tactics have served to promote the interests of white middle-class gay and lesbian folks. But if you're transgender, if you're a black same-sex couple, if you're an immigrant, if you're someone who's been incarcerated, if you're low-income, if you're a senior citizen, these kinds of messages don't really help you, right? We live in a country where the just like you people are a married, white, nuclear family. But for communities of color, they've never lived in that. Straight folks or LGBT folks have never lived that way. African Americans tend to live in a much more it takes a village kind of arrangement, with aunts or kin helping raise children. Immigrants to this country, they move in and then double and triple up households with cousins living together, right? So who is the just like you who's the you in that? The you has been we have centered an entire movement around the patterns of white middle class straight folks so that white middle class gay and lesbian folks can try and replicate that, and thus erasing the needs of everyone else in the movement.
And in fact, where people, it seems to me, a lot of the promotion of marriage equality also has this sense of we also put all of our lives and commitments into the nuclear family and to living together like in the romanticized suburb. In some ways, that's tragic because the LGBT movement at its beginning was so communal, so democratic. It didn't revolve around family, but around other kinds of commitments and real political commitments to live differently.
Absolutely, but I think it's important to look at the political commitment involved in the nuclear family, because although most people don't think of it that way, the idea of building your life around the nuclear family is part and parcel of the neoliberal agenda of the last 20 years. The state, the government, has a vested interest in promoting marriage, because marriage, many have argued, marriage is a form of privatizing caregiving. Right? You can imagine living in a country where old people didn't have to move in with their adult children to take care of them, or where we had universal child care and we knew what we were going to do with our kids from age 1 to 5 before they start preschool. Right now, people have to take care of those kids on their own, or going into the hospital and having surgery and then being released 2 days later and being told your family has to take care of you. Like, caregiving in this country is privatized, and the government structures it in a way that says, get married, have a family, and they will take care of you, which is great. Like, I want my family to take care of me too, but it also serves to release the government from that responsibility of taking care of old people or taking care of preschool kids by providing child care or taking care of the sick after they're released from the hospital. That marriage serves a real political function, and it's a very different politics. It's a very neoliberal politics of privatization that's vastly different from the politics of free love or community or a broader range of social justice that many gay groups were fighting for in the 60s and 70s.
Joseph DeFilippis, we're right on the verge of talking about the new queer agenda. What do you see now that marriage equality has prevailed in so many ways and in so many states and places, and it seems on the upswing? It's clear that the focus, the overwhelming sort of focus of the LGBT community has somehow been seduced into, is going to have to change. And why don't you give us your sort of sense of what the future holds and should hold?
I think there are a few priority issues, I would say, what the future should hold post-marriage victories. And one is protection of other family structures, right? So in Oregon, we don't know yet if we're going to lose domestic partnerships or not now that we have gay marriage. And I encourage all your listeners to call Basic Rights Oregon and say, great, we got marriage. Now make sure you also keep domestic partnerships for people who need them, because Oregon could go either way. We don't know. In addition to protecting families, I would also argue that we have an epidemic of poverty in the LGBT community, and that we have this media image of being Will and Grace and Modern Family and all these white middle-class lives, but in fact, poverty rates are higher in every single subpopulation of the LGBT community except gay white men. And even gay white men actually make less than their heterosexual counterparts. But if you're a lesbian couple, poverty rates are much higher. Children being raised in same-sex households have double the poverty rate of children in heterosexual households. For black folks, for people of color, for transgender folks, for senior citizens, every one of those groups have wildly disproportionate poverty rates. And that fact has been completely ignored by the mainstream gay rights movement. Report after report has come out in the last 10 years examining all of these different pockets of our movement, of senior citizens, homeless youth, transgender folks, Latino communities, black communities, Asian communities, lesbians, like every group is facing much higher poverty rates than the average American. And that issue has been completely absent from the LGBT movement. So that would need to be taken care of, I would argue, should be the next priority. There's many other things I could talk about as well, but you know, the criminal justice system and the way that it targets particularly transgender folks, particularly queer people of color, that needs to be addressed. We have an aging community of LGBT seniors that often have no social security even to count on because of the homophobia or transphobia they experienced in their lives. They had to work at jobs that were off the books, and so they weren't paying into social security, and now they are old and have nothing to count on. So there's lots and lots of issues. This publication, A New Queer Agenda, that we did with Barnard College, has lots of articles about lots of ways that the movement should redirect itself and what kinds of issues are waiting to be tackled.
Including this, the issue which is now rising of low-wage labor, the great rising of that whole class of baristas and retail workers and fast food workers and all of the others.
Absolutely.
Joseph DeFilippis, really good talking to you. Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. It's been fun.
So long. Hi, folks. The music you just heard was Abdul Dumbia. The song is Dimbaya by Abdul Dumbia. Before that, you heard Joseph DeFilippis talking about marriage equality and the future of LGBT activism. Coming up on The Old Mole later, Jan Hocken talks with the organizers of a celebration of West African dance and music coming this Friday to Portland State. Three distinct groups of drummers and dancers will perform traditional music that builds bridges to the history of the nations and the tribes that inhabit them. Later on The Mole, I, Bill Resnick, bring you an up-to-date on Iraq and the collapse of the Iraqi armed forces in much of northern Iraq. Next on The Mole, Jan Hocken talks with Sophie Smith, an activist with People Helping People in the Border Zone. Jan and Sophia.
Welcome to KABU, Sophie Smith.
Hi, Jan. Thanks so much for having me back.
Yeah. You are part of a group in Aravaca, Arizona, organizing to provide humanitarian aid to migrants along the U.S.-Mexico border. And you were on our show a few months ago talking about the campaign you were launching on checkpoints and the borderlands. So we're now checking in with you to see how that campaign is going. First of all, why don't you give us some background? What happens at these checkpoints and why the campaign specifically focused on these internal checkpoints?
Sure. So to give you an idea of the area that we're talking about, I am in the humanitarian aid office in Aravaca right now, 11 miles north from the border between the U.S. and Mexico. And this town, like many border towns, is situated south of a system of inland border patrol checkpoints on all major highways and freeways leading out of these areas. So what that looks like in Arizona is there are 11 inland checkpoints. They're situated anywhere from 25 to 75 miles north of the actual line between the U.S. and Mexico, which means that all traffic leaving this area, all northbound traffic, has to stop at a Border Patrol checkpoint and go through an interview with an immigration enforcement agent in order to continue on their way. And these checkpoints arrived after 9/11. They were placed at various times. The main one leading in and out of Aravaca town, which is a very small town of 700 people, arrived about 7 years ago. All Border Patrol checkpoints in Arizona are by definition temporary and tactical, but you know, in our seventh year here in Aravaca, folks are seeing that this checkpoint's probably not going to go away anytime soon. And I think what's important to understand about what these checkpoints are doing, their stated purpose is to stop vehicles, inspect vehicles, profile passengers in order to enforce immigration law. But what I think is really important to understand that these checkpoints also do is they create a kind of second inland line of traversal for folks crossing through the desert in this region. We are in a massive migration funnel here in the rural area of Aravaca, Arizona, and those walking through the desert to reach the U.S. without papers now must walk not only across the border, but across the second border created by the inland system of checkpoints before they can get a ride further into the U.S. interior. So in this region, that means that folks are walking more than 25 miles through the desert. West of here in Ajo, the checkpoint is 60 miles inland, so folks are walking a lot further. And in Texas, South Texas, there's checkpoints as much as close to 90 miles north of the line. So you can kind of get an idea of the strategic part that these checkpoints are playing in a DHS, a Department of Homeland Security strategy that's forcing people into the desert further into remote areas and punishing undocumented migration with the kind of suffering and death that happens in this very hot climate and landscape.
And so, in a sense, this militarizing of the borderlands through the checkpoints is meant to project internally a sense of the Border Patrol as the protectors of locals. And yet your campaign has mobilized a kind of alliance between migrants and locals in resistance to the checkpoints. How have you managed that, where there's been a, instead of dividing migrants as dangerous foreigners against the security provided by border control, that kind of a discourse, you've been able to shift the discourse and shift the politics there. Right. How have you achieved that through this checkpoint campaign?
Well, before the checkpoint campaign was launched, which was a year ago in town, there was already about a year and a half effort to really promote humanitarian aid and hospitality in this area. And I think what you find, migration started to be funneled through this region in the mid-1990s after the passage of legislation, Operation Gatekeeper, Operation Hold the Line, and Operation Safeguard, and the kind of recreation of Border Patrol strategy around militarizing traditional ports of entry in cities where unauthorized migration had flowed through in the past, and instead funneling it into remote areas. So,
which is also a much harder journey, right?
Right, and that was sort of the concept. It's called prevention through deterrence, and the idea was that the desert and its natural hazards would create a natural deterrent to unauthorized migration by increasing the risk and cost associated with crossing. So that all happened, started in the mid to late 90s, and folks living in this area started receiving migration traffic before there was really a large enforcement presence. Border Patrol really descended en masse here after 9/11 once enforcement in the region became integrated into the war on terror. So I think there was already an ethic in this region of giving aid, giving water, and giving hospitality to folks crossing. I think that targeting the checkpoint was a the choice of the checkpoint as a target has been sort of an observation that, on the one hand, getting rid of inland checkpoints will certainly push back against this kind of law enforcement strategy against migration that is really tragic and really heartbreaking to see. But I think also the function of these checkpoints is sort of a general policing function with the local population. The fact that all residents who have citizenship status have to pass through, stop, submit to questioning, at times be pulled into secondary inspection and have dogs go into their car and take their car apart, and there have been incidents of verbal and physical abuse at this checkpoint. I mean, I think this checkpoint has also had a really negative impact on local life here. It's caused property values to plummet because it marks the whole region as dangerous, and the kids who grow up in Aravaca, the school bus has to pass through the checkpoint every day and be inspected. So I think part of the thinking was that targeting the checkpoint was a point of intersection of the interests of migrant justice and also the self-interest of the local population in a kind of anti-policing way, if that makes sense.
Now, describe the monitoring campaign itself and, yeah. and what you've done and what you've tried to achieve. And describe again the scene of what happens with these monitors.
Right. So local residents with some supporters started monitoring the checkpoint on Aravaca Road at the end of February for a two-month effort, and they monitored, they recorded and documented about 2,400 vehicles stopping at the checkpoint in that time and over 25 monitoring sessions, I think. So what this looked like was three or four folks going out with clipboards and standing. They were actually pushed back by Border Patrol the first 2 days of monitoring and threatened with arrest. Border Patrol reacted to the attempt to monitor their activities by establishing an enforcement no pedestrian zone around the actual checkpoint, which pushed monitors out of a proximity where they could actually hear what questioning was going on. So monitors were standing about 400 feet back from the actual checkpoint. And this effort was initiated with a few different goals. One was to actually document what happens at the checkpoint, because Border Patrol is required to keep those statistics themselves and have not historically. So just to get some actual statistics on the specific checkpoint and what it does. The second was to deter abuse as kind of a cop watch inspired effort, thinking that having third party observation would reduce the number of people being pulled into secondary inspection without probable cause. And then the last goal was to keep resistance visible in the campaign after we had petitioned and protested and things like this last fall. So at this point, monitoring continues, but sporadically, and we are compiling the data that monitors recorded during those sessions and starting to do some analysis of that data to understand what our findings are. And I could speak a little bit about the preliminary impressions of that, if that's helpful.
Yeah, getting back to the aims or the goals of mm-hmm. this kind of research of the people, research carried, it's like a form of field research carried out in a community setting. What the first aim of documenting what happens at the checkpoints could affect aim two of deterring abusive behavior. So perhaps
right.
it was important in some ways to understand or take into account that the observers themselves would influence the extent or frequency of abusive behavior at the checkpoints.
Right. And absolutely.
So was that then, it sounds like you didn't hold all of your, have all of your data loaded up on those first two aims, but the third one may be particularly important, of making resistance in the community visible,
right.
pushing back, not just simply observing a phenomenon that exists in some static way, but the process of observing it itself is a political intervention.
Right. And, you know, I think the modders were out there with bright neon vests on and a big sign, you know, explaining what they were doing, and had a lot of conversations with folks leaving the area. But I think that that's right to an extent, that the presence of the monitors certainly altered the behavior of Border Patrol. And we heard anecdotes in town from folks who'd been perpetually harassed and targeted, reporting that when monitors were there, Border Patrol was radically different in their behavior and a lot nicer. I think what isn't altered, though, is that in these, for 2,400 vehicles passing through, there were no apprehensions of folks crossing through the desert at that checkpoint in any of those cases. There were no drug seizures or interdictions, and that wouldn't have been altered by the presence of monitors. And so I think what that directs our attention to is that while the stated aim by the Department of Homeland Security for these checkpoints is to catch folks who are crossing without papers, the actual strategic function of these checkpoints is more of the order that I was describing earlier, of pushing people further into the desert. The location of these checkpoints is no secret, and migrant traffic routes around them. And so what I think the absence of statistics around drug seizures and apprehensions is really telling about these checkpoints being part of a much more lethal strategy in this desert.
So the checkpoints are both a symbolic and a practical political site of a larger struggle over the militarizing of the borderlands. And it sounds like with this local support, it provides an important example for groups in so many places of the country and the world who are mobilized around their fear of outsiders, their fears of immigrants and migrants, and how this becomes fodder for a lot of right-wing kind of populist campaigns. And here there's a very different message that it sounds like started with a kind of ethic of hospitality and welcoming migrants. What is the next step? And in closing, let us know how we can support the efforts there.
Oh, sure. Well, what's happening right now is we are preparing for a national day of action of Know Your Rights at Checkpoints that is part of the Southern Border Communities Coalition Revitalize Not Militarize campaign. That'll be on July 9th. And then also preparing an actual report of the data and the analysis, and doing a public presentation and press conference at the beginning of August. So that's sort of the preparations afoot. And we're also really excited that the border community just to the east of us, Tubac, has now released a petition opposing their checkpoint on the I-19. And we are also in conversation with folks in Patagonia and Ajo and on the Tohono O'odham Reservation. So it really feels like there's momentum and possible for some unity across border communities on this issue. And we're really hoping, because we believe that we can't get rid of one checkpoint really without getting rid of them all, at least within the state. So that's where things are at. It's a really exciting time. We're also really returning to promoting humanitarian aid right now. It's hovering around 100 degrees every day. July is a very deadly month here. Human remains were just recovered just south of town this week.
So our listeners can find out more about how to support campaigns there and the efforts of people helping people in the border zone through your website. Just in closing, can you give us your website?
Yeah, please visit the website. It's www.phparavaca.org. phparavaca.org, and you can donate and look at some of the press coverage that we have.
Important and inspiring work. Keep up the good work, and we'll keep following the activism there over the summer. Thanks so much for being with us today, Sophie Smith.
Thanks so much for having me, Jan.
Well, that bit of music was a little bit more by Abdul Dumbia, the song Dumbaya again. And thanks to Jan and Sophia for their discussion of the borderlands. This is KB Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, your Old Mole Variety Hour. The Old Mole explores the near countless struggles from below that one fine day will unite in a vast movement to reconstruct this country and ultimately the world, and none too soon. That's the great hope, or the age of Homo sapiens will end. Coming up on KBOO today at 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Locus Focus with guest host Kathleen Stevenson talking to Andrew Krimbrell of the Center for Food Safety. They'll discuss genetically engineered crops, the campaign to label them, and a campaign to ban them. Then later on KBOO this morning at 11, we offer Richard Wolf an update on today's economy as the Great Recession continues for so many, as the rich get fabulously richer. Next on The Mole, I'm Bill Resnick. I've been reading a lot on the recent turn of events in Iraq, and I prepared a little primer on what's happening. That is, the forces in conflict, what is likely for the future, and what is thought to be done by the left. First, what happened? What happened is that much of northern Iraq, last week it happened, much of northern Iraq, including Iraq's second largest city, the territory is mostly Sunni. It was captured by what could be a temporary and opportunistic coalition of forces opposing the Shiite Muslim government. It was put in power by the U.S. It's headquartered in the south of Iraq in Baghdad. The invasion was from Syria. It appears to have been led by a group called, at least the group is getting a lot of press in the United States, called the ISIS. That's short for Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. They were joined by other Sunni Muslims who hated the current government led by Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who's a militant Shiite. Everybody agrees that the Maliki high command ran things to enrich and empower themselves, and also to settle scores with the Sunnis who had run Iraq for centuries before the Bush administration invaded in March 2003. One important question is what's likely to happen into these battling Iraqi forces? As to the ISIS, it actually began 5 years ago in the Sunni part of northern Iraq, but their initial brutality was so extreme that they earned the hatred of the Sunni tribes of that area. The U.S. then deeply involved in Iraq, but not doing very well, as it never has done, saw a big opportunity. The U.S. armed and paid the tribes to attack the ISIS, who withdrew and reformed in Syria, just across the border. And during the Syrian civil war, when the government had to withdraw from that area, defending itself in other areas, the ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, they seized large parts of Syria in the Syrian civil war. They then last week recrossed the border, not a surprise to some, but to the and they gained strength that they were moving forward. The government forces that the U.S. has given over $20 billion, some report, to create, arm, and train, they were apparently terrified. They had lots of men, much more than the ISIS and their coalition, but they didn't even bother to destroy their equipment, so it all fell into the arms of the rebels, the rebel coalition. They put down their arms and fled on foot, many captured and executed. What about this rebel force? It seems to be led by the ISIS, at least they're getting the major part of the press, but it includes Baathists, I'll explain who they are later, as well as the tribes that 5 years ago had driven out the ISIS, but they've now made peace with the ISIS. The question is, can this mixed force stick together after the recent victory? I don't think it's very likely. That's because the ISIS wants to create their own state carved out of Iraq and Iran that would operate on the strictest conceivable Sharia law, like women cannot leave the home alone except in emergencies, and many other restrictions. No music. It's no haircuts. And the ISIS would impose that on everybody in the region that they militarily control. They also gleefully execute people who disagree with them. At least that's what the videos on the internet seem to demonstrate. But the Ba'athist Party that used to run Iraq, they are secular Muslims. They cut their beards. They like going out with their women, who worked as teachers in many other roles. Anyway, the Ba'athists will not accept ISIS control of their lives. And furthermore, the Ba'athists, some want to regain power over Iraq. Others might be satisfied with the power-sharing arrangement in a united Iraq. But none want to live in an ISIS-controlled Sharia paradise. As to the Sunni tribes, they just want to get out from under the heel of the Maliki government. They want to be left alone, and they will also not accept ISIS rule. Anyway, these various groups routed the Maliki army, the Ba'athists, the ISIS, the tribes, and several others, smaller groups. But they will likely go into a rivalry of who rules what under what roles, and they are quite likely to start killing one another, as in fact is happening in Syria now, a battle amongst the people who are opposed to the Assad regime. Anyway, the Maliki government is also riven by armed factions who don't want to cooperate with one another. And then there's another set of people, the Kurds of northern Iraq, who are themselves pretty unified, but they don't want to be part of Iraq. They want their own independent state. So you might ask, why not do that? Why not just partition Iraq and give parts to the Kurds, parts to the Sunnis, parts to the Shiites? Joe Biden, the vice president, floated that proposal some years ago. It was ignored. Probably going to be ignored again. The answer is that why the Iraqi forces don't want to, some want partition, others don't, but they all want the oil revenue, and there's very little oil in Shiite Iraq. The Sunnis and the Kurds have a good deal of oil, the Sunni regions. Anyway, the Shiite elites and high priests, they can only enjoy opulent lives if they control the oil, so they're definitely going to keep fighting. Anyway, those are only the local, and those are only the local forces. Iraq now is not just, however, a local struggle. In fact, partition is also rejected by nearly all the other countries of the region, all of them involved, and the U.S. and Europe involved too. So Shiite Iran is backing Iraq's Shiites and also backing Shiites in Lebanon and Syria, and none of these Shiite groups could survive. They'd all be killed by these by their own local Sunnis if they got isolated. Now, these are not, though, however, mostly religious conflicts, even though they're composed of different religious groups. It's much more like Northern Ireland, where they're really fighting about who controls the wealth of the country. Northern Ireland, of course, the Protestants were forced ultimately to share some with the Catholics. But that process took a long time and lots of killing. And that could happen again in Iraq, a lot of killing, much more. And let's then turn, though, to the Saudi royal family, other outside forces who are very active in Iraq. As to the Sunni Saudi royal family and most of the Emirates, they are backing the Sunnis in Iraq, even though the ISIS is far more radical than the Sunnis and than the Saudi royal family. And they, in fact, would happily kill the Saudis if they could. But the Saudis, of course, are more afraid of Shiite power and a rising of its own Shiites than of radical Sunnis who they seem to be paying off. And then there's Turkey. They have a large and restive Kurd population, and they cannot afford to allow a Kurdish state that their Kurds would fight to join, so they're also opposed to partition. And then there's the U.S., also opposed to partition. They just want to keep the oil and profits flowing, so they will back any force who can do that with one condition. The rulers of Iraq cannot stage terrorist attacks on the U.S. But the U.S. cannot by itself appoint the rulers of Iraq. They could, of course, kill hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq, stage an invasion as John McCain and the Republicans seem to be calling for, but that wouldn't do any good. It would only earn more enmity from all of the groups who are already hating the U.S. And so it appears the Obama administration is moving on a different front. It's trying to broker some sort of deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia to stop, who are antagonists, to stop funding the Iraqi antagonists, to call off those dogs. John Kerry, the Secretary of State, announced this morning that the U.S. is open to talking to Iran. But even if these divided outside powers were to agree on something, Iraqi forces on the ground do not want to give up their goals and interests. Anyway, I've been addressing the current situation of Iraq now that a Sunni force, some of them the most extreme jihadis, took over much of northern Iraq. The last issue is, what should the U.S. peace movement do? Well, we can do the same thing we've been doing for the last 10 years, and it could turn out to be effective over time. We can say, I told you so, you should have never invaded Iraq. We can also say no blood for oil. We can try and force the pullback of U.S. Imperium and our far-flung military bases. We could also try to support the remnants of Middle Eastern left. But the U.S., Europeans, and Israelis have destroyed the Middle Eastern left, killed its leadership, dispersed its forces. The big strategic thinkers of the West and Israel, they were under the impression that once the left was exterminated, they could keep control forever, based on the assumption that the remaining groups in the Middle East, mostly Islamists of one kind or another, were just other worldly religious types and would never raise armies and contest for power and money. That Western strategy, of course, turned out to be less than brilliant. So there's really no major force for the left in the conflict to support. Anyway, there's a lot that the left could do, basically fighting for social justice and building movements that would gain that across the world. It's not an impossible dream. In fact, it's necessary. This was Bill Resnick for The Old Mole, trying to make sense of the latest turn events in Iraq. I'm going to introduce next on The Mole the song Korizhuga by the Barry Ensemble there from Mali. After that, Jan Hocken talks to two of the directors' performance of The Village, an African rhythm and dance performance at Lincoln Hall. It's this Friday. Thanks.
So you're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour, and finishing up the show this morning, we have performers, directors with The Village, an African rhythm and dance performance that will be here, Lincoln Hall, this coming Friday. Durell Siku Sumawakar and Rolia Manyanga Jones. Let's start with Rolia, tell us about The Village and what the performance consists of, and then we'll talk about some of the ideas behind the project.
The Village is a collective performance that we're going to be having with three groups, Sibikan, Kukata Nature African Dance Troupe, and Barama Kono, who is a drum ensemble group. And it is very important that we bring the village together, because most of the artists that are dancers and instructors and kids, they are all kind of related. And it's going to be fun to see mom and daughters and all dancing. And it's just, as an African woman, I think it is my responsibility to teach and bring people together. And let's show people the good things that come out of Northeast Portland. Is not just shooting and all of those bad things. We do have good things that come out of Northeast Portland, and the village is going to be a representation of that.
And good things coming out of Africa, often there's a kind of tragic narrative that is so associated with Africa as well, that this also brings into view the rich and vibrant traditions that that immigrants for some time have brought from various areas of Africa, in this case West Africa, to the United States. I mean, the concept of the village, of course, has become kind of a cliche. It takes a village to raise a child, but you take that quite seriously, the idea of the village and who's included in that village. Darrell, can you speak to the importance of that village concept for education? And now with a lot of the standardized testing being questioned around the country with that, the common core curriculum that puts so much emphasis on standardized testing, English math scores that leave so many youth behind, including and maybe particularly immigrant youth. What is the importance of music and dance to the kind of the scholarly agenda of schooling that is a part of that village? How we educate children into the culture they inherit?
Yeah, well, being a art teacher, actually, I teach West African dance and music in the school district. I see it's so important. It balances a child out, gives them confidence. Physical activity is very important. A lot of programs are lacking the physical activity that our children need to succeed. And in my class in particular, translates to the classroom structure fairly easily, in particular, like social studies. We've done units in social studies and with dance that deal with West African countries, religions such as Islam and Christianity in those West African countries. My students learn a lot about not just dance movements, but the culture, where it's from, why a certain culture would do this dance or this play this rhythm in a particular setting. And, you know, I feel that they leave my classroom with that confidence and that knowledge, and they can go to, you know, their normal classrooms and be able to be confident in what they know or what they're gonna learn. Just, you know, learning how to learn is, you know, important also. And I just feel that arts and music in schools is so important.
And it's been kind of shunted aside or not taken seriously, particularly in the U.S. And yet, I think you're saying that history itself is often transmitted through movement. I mean, I think many people are familiar with the idea of oral traditions, but there's also movement traditions. Mm-hmm. Can you say a bit about the drumming, which is going to be a featured part of the village performance on Friday? What the kind of deeper meanings of drumming are in transmitting culture? There's a beat. A certain beat.
I know from experience that, you know, music and drumming rhythm, it, you know, it pierces the soul. You know, it speaks to your soul, speaks to who you are.
There's something very grounding about it.
Yes,
too.
Definitely, and especially for African-American children to have a sense of, you know, where they may come from. And
yeah, Rulia, could you speak to that in closing? How, I mean, there's often conflict between African-American youth or communities and the migrant or immigrant and refugee communities. And maybe instead of answering that question, you can tell us how that question will be addressed on Friday and give us information. I see we're out of time for today, but that this is intended to bridge communities within that village.
Well, I don't think there's a conflict. I just think there's miscommunication. And when we started like we've Kukatona Children African Dance Troupe has been assisting for 30 years. And when we taking the program out of the school and it's in the community and we have 15 different schools we are dealing with, we will bridge that gap and we educate the kids and the misunderstanding would be gone.
This is an important and deep and sustained aim that goes beyond the Friday performance. Just in closing, how can people get tickets? It's 7:30 p.m. this Friday at Lincoln Hall at Portland State University. There's sliding scale fees. So there's support for youth, students, and others who can't afford the full fee. Where do people find tickets in closing?
They can go to www.kukatona.org, and it will connect them to Portland State University box office.
Okay, and how do you spell that?
KUKATONON.
And it'll also be posted on our website. Thanks so much for being here with us today, performers and directors with the Village. We look forward to the performance on Friday.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Well, folks, that ends the Old Mole today. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Bill Resnick signing off. Joe Clements, our engineer. Bye-bye and have a good KBOO morning.
Monday at 10:15 a.m. on Locust Focus, Andrew Kimbrell of the Center for Food Safety on the dangers of genetically engineered food.
We are at peak herbicides. We don't have any really new ones. So we're going from Roundup, which is wide spectrum and not considered that harmful, to more harmful, more toxic herbicides, 2,4-D, and then dicamba. And that'll all be stacked together. So you'll have corn and soy that will be resistant to Roundup, 2,4-D, and dicamba, over 50% of our farmland. Imagine that toxic load. That is the nightmare future that these chemical companies have for us.
That's this Monday at 10:15 on Locust Focus on KBOO Portland.